and we are all alike. We're ready to eat anything, especially cooked blubber, which none of us would tackle before. Probably living totally in the open and having to rely on food instead of fire for body heat makes us think so much of food. They were up at 6 the following morning, November 5th, and nearly everyone returned to the ship. Several men attempted some personal salvage operations. Macklin went after a Bible his mother had given him. He crawled through a hole in the slanting deckhouse to reach the passageway leading to his old cabin. In the passageway, he had to stand on a handrail above the ice and water, an inch's way down, crouching over. But his progress was halted at the water's edge, some 12 feet short of the cabin. He could see the door down under the dark, icy water, but he couldn't reach it. Greenstreet was luckier and managed to get far enough into his cabin to secure a few books. Howe and Bakewell, whose quarters in the forecastle were hopelessly submerged, went treasure hunting elsewhere. Carefully making their way along a passageway below, they passed the door of the compartment Hurley had used as a darkroom. Looking in, they saw the cases containing Hurley's photographic negatives. After hesitating a moment, the two seamen squeezed past the half-jammed door, stepped into the ankle-deep water, and grabbed the cases off the shelves. It was a real treasure, and they returned the negatives to Hurley that night. As a whole, the salvage party worked with abandon, scarcely considering the usefulness of each item removed. And indeed, there was very little from the ship that couldn't be used in one way or another. Wood could always serve as fuel for cooking. Canvas was useful for ground covers and for patching tents. Ropes could be made into sledge harnesses. The men removed the entire wheelhouse as a unit and returned it to camp to serve as a sort of portable storehouse. Lumber, spars, sails, and rigging followed. They worked until nearly 5 o'clock, and then returned to camp, bringing one final load with them. As they trudged along beside the sledges, Hurley spotted a large Weddell seal about 1,000 yards off to the right. He had no gun with which to kill it, so he took a piece of wood and approached the seal cautiously. When he was close enough, he stunned the animal with his club. Then he brained it with a mountaineer's pickaxe. 2 other seals were killed in this fashion on the way back to camp. But the amount of stores thus far salvaged from the ship was disappointingly small. Most of the provisions were below decks in what had been the Ritz. To get at them would require tearing the deck away, and it was more than 1 foot thick in places and nearly 3 feet underwater. But it was imperative that the stores be obtained. So the next day, McNeish was put in charge, and after hours of work with ice chisels and various rigs of tackle, the party wrenched and pried a hole through the deck. Almost immediately, stores began to float up, beginning with a barrel of walnuts. Other supplies were grappled to the surface, a case of sugar, a box full of baking soda. By the end of the day, nearly 3.5 tons of flour, rice, sugar, barley, lentils, vegetables, and jam had been rescued and sledged back to camp. It was an extremely rewarding haul, and the whole party was jubilant. Green prepared them a treat of curried seal for supper in celebration. But after the first bite, most of the men could hardly swallow more. Green had put in easily 3 times too much curry. "I had to eat it to satisfy my hunger," Macklin later wrote in his diary. "But now my mouth is like a lime kiln, and I'm almost parched with thirst." Salvage work had to be suspended on the afternoon of November the 6th, when a southerly blizzard came up and drove the men into their tents. It was their first blizzard on the ice. The tents shook and rattled with the force of the gale, while the men huddled inside, cold and cramped. The only cheering thought was that the gale was driving them north, towards civilization, so infinitely far away. Shackleton took the opportunity to meet with Wilde, Worsley, and Hurley to evaluate their food situation. They now had some 4.5 tons of stores, not counting the concentrated sledging ration which was to have been used by the 6-man transcontinental party, and which Shackleton intended to save for emergencies. They reckoned their food supplies would last 3 months, at full rations, and since they were sure to get increasing numbers of seals and penguins, they decided it was safe to go on full rations for the next 2 months. This would carry them into January, the midpoint of the Antarctic summer. By that time, Shackleton was sure, they would know what fate lay in store for them. Then the ultimate decision would have to be made, while there was still time to act before the onslaught of winter. Everything depended on the drift of the pack. The ice might continue to go generally northwest, carrying them toward the Palmer Peninsula, possibly as far as the South Orkney Islands, some 500-odd miles to the north. Or the drift might be arrested for some reason, and they would remain more or less in the same spot. Finally, the pack might veer northeast, or even east, carrying them away from land. Whatever happened, January would mark the point of no return. If the drift was toward land, they should have enough open water by then to launch the boats and make for the most promising spot. It seemed reasonable, in theory at least. If the pack were to stop moving, that fact would be apparent by January. Then, rather than spend the winter camped on the ice, the party would abandon their boats, except for a small punt the carpenter had built, and make a dash for the nearest land, using the punt to ferry across any open water they ran into. It would be a risky business, but better than wintering on the ice. The third prospect was grim indeed. If the pack drifted northeast or east, and if they were unable to launch the boats, they would have to spend the winter adrift on the floes, somehow surviving the polar night with its paralyzing cold and violent storms. If this were to happen, they would know by January. And there would still be time to lay in meat to see them through. But nobody even cared to think much about such a possibility. Chapter 3. The presence of Frank Hurley at this high-level meeting about the food situation had special significance. He was invited not because of his Antarctic experience. There were several others, such as Alf Cheatham or Tom Crean, who were much more knowledgeable, but because Shackleton did not want to antagonize him. The incident revealed one of Shackleton's basic traits. Though he was virtually fearless in the physical sense, he suffered an almost pathological dread of losing control of the situation. In part, this attitude grew out of a consuming sense of responsibility. He felt he had gotten them into their situation, and it was his responsibility to get them out. As a consequence, he was intensely watchful for potential troublemakers who might nibble away at the unity of the group. Shackleton felt that if dissension arose, the party as a whole might not put forth that added ounce of energy which could mean, at a time of crisis, the difference between survival and defeat. Thus he was prepared to go to almost any length to keep the party close-knit and under his control. Though Hurley was a skilled photographer and an excellent worker, he was also the sort of man who responded best to flattery, who frequently needed to be jollied along and made to feel important. Shackleton sensed this need. He may even have overestimated it. And he was afraid that unless he catered to it, Hurley might feel slighted and possibly spread discontent among the others. And so Shackleton frequently sought Hurley's opinion, and he was careful to compliment him on his work. He also assigned Hurley to his own tent, which appealed to Hurley's snobbishness, and also minimized his opportunities for gathering other latent malcontents around himself. Several other tent assignments were made, with an eye to avoiding trouble. Shackleton shared number one tent with Hudson, the navigator, and James, the physicist, as well as Hurley. Although neither of these men was by any means a troublemaker, Shackleton seemed concerned that they might cause friction if they were in close contact with the others too long. Hudson was just as he had always been, simple and a little irritating. His attempts at humour were often more foolish than funny, because he lacked perception. He was a young dandy, a little impressed with his own good looks, but really not too sure of himself. As a result of this fundamental insecurity, he was quite self-centred and a poor listener. He could be counted on to interrupt any conversation to inject something about himself, even though what he said bore no relation to the subject being discussed. And his self-centeredness made it difficult for him to tell when his leg was being pulled, as was the case in the practical joke from which he got his nickname Buddha. Strangely, he seemed to enjoy a joke on himself. At least it gave him the chance to occupy center stage. Shackleton was not at all fond of Hudson, but he preferred putting up with him to inflicting him on others. As for James, he probably never should have gone with the expedition at all. He had an academic background and a rather sheltered upbringing. He was a scholar and an extremely capable and dedicated scientist, but in practical matters he was very unhandy and a little unwilling. The adventurous side of the expedition, which was its chief appeal for most of the other men, interested James very little. In personality, he was roughly the antithesis of Shackleton. For James's own sake, as much as for any other reason, Shackleton took him into his own tent. The assignment of McNeish to No. 2 tent under Wilde's care was also a calculated move. As a ship's carpenter, McNeish was a master craftsman. Nobody ever saw him use a ruler. He simply studied a job briefly, then set to work sawing the proper pieces, and they always fitted exactly. But McNeish, though physically a giant of a man, and proportionately strong, was 56 years old, more than twice the average age of the other expedition members, and he was troubled with piles. He was homesick, too, almost from the day the expedition sailed. In fact, nobody really understood why he came at all. Whatever the reason, McNeish tended to be querulous, and because of his long experience as a mariner, he fancied himself something of a sea lawyer, well-versed in the rights of seamen. All things considered, Shackleton felt McNeish could bear some watching, and he instructed Wilde accordingly. But even dour old McNeish was happy during the blizzard which blew up out of the southeast on November the 6th. Though it kept the men in their tents and living conditions were miserable, they were certain it was giving them a considerable shove to the north. "We all hope it lasts for a month," McNeish wrote. It did last for 48 hours, and when the weather cleared, Worsley obtained a sight which showed that they had blown 16 miles northwest, a highly satisfactory run. That afternoon, Shackleton went back to the ship with a small party and three of the dog teams to continue salvage operations. But the Endurance had sunk another 18 inches and was just about level with the surface of the ice. Further salvage would be impossible. Just before leaving, the party fired a signal bomb as a salute in farewell to the Endurance. The men began the next day to build a lookout tower out of the odds and ends of spars and planking they had brought back from the ship, and McNeish went to work on a better sledge for the whaler, using some of the tremendously strong Greenheart sheathing that had once protected the sides of the Endurance from the ice. The days now were considerably longer than the nights, with the sun setting about 9 p.m. and rising again near 3 o'clock in the morning. In the evenings, there was plenty of light for reading or playing cards. Frequently, Hussey took his banjo around to the galley tent, where the flicker of flame in the blubber stove warmed his fingers enough to play, and there was always a good turnout of singers. The 7 men under Worsley's charge in No. 5 tent instituted the practice of reading aloud each night. Clark was first, and he chose a volume inappropriately titled Science from an Easy Chair. Clark and his 7 listeners lay snuggling together for warmth, arranged in a circle around the tent, with their feet thrust under a pile of sleeping bags to generate a little collective heat. When it came to Greenstreet's turn, he elected to read Sir Walter Scott's Marmion, and Macklin allowed as how, "I must confess, I find his reading an excellent soporific." Underlying the optimism and good spirits of the party was a deep-seated confidence that their situation was only temporary. Things were certain to improve before very long. Summer was coming. They were positive that the drift of the pack, which had been at a creeping pace, would pick up speed. Even if it didn't, the summer weather would loosen the ice, and they could take to the boats. On November the 12th, 4 days after the end of the blizzard, the wind swung around to the north, and suddenly summer seemed to arrive. The thermometer rose to a record 35 degrees, and several of the men stripped to the waist to indulge in the luxury of a wash in the snow. Otherwise, the heat wave made living conditions increasingly miserable. During the daytime, it was almost stiflingly hot in the tents. Shackleton once recorded a temperature of 82 degrees in his. Worsley insisted that he could actually see the snow turning into water. The surface of the floe became a quagmire of melted snow and rotting ice. Walking was treacherous, because the porous ice would unexpectedly give way. letting a man plunge into a water-filled ice pocket up to his knees or even his waist. Sledging heavy seals back to camp was worst of all.